Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 2, investigates allegations surrounding one of the most powerful religious figures of the 21st century, T.B. Joshua. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 23rd of January, these are our main stories. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the offensive in Gaza despite the deaths of 21 soldiers in a single incident. Voting is underway in New Hampshire, where Donald Trump is seeking to seal his nomination as the Republican presidential candidate. And the Oscar nominations are in. Also in this podcast, the wives of Russian servicemen are speaking out against the war in Ukraine.
When will they decide that our husbands have discharged their military duty? When they are brought back to us with no arms and legs?
We start in Jerusalem, where there were prayers at the funeral of an Israeli soldier killed in Gaza on Monday. He was among 21 reservists who died. Three other soldiers were killed in a separate incident. This was the biggest daily loss of life in Israel's military since its ground operations began in Gaza in October. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, expressed his condolences.
Yesterday was one of the hardest days since the war broke out. We lost 24 of our best sons, the heroes who fell defending the homeland, together with the citizens of Israel. I grieve for each and every one of them.
Mr. Netanyahu went on to say that the Israeli military is looking into what he called the disaster, and Israel would push for what he called, quote, absolute victory. I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen, how the soldiers were killed.
Well, the chief spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces, Daniel Hagari, has said that the soldiers were preparing explosives to bring down two buildings when what he described as a militant or a terrorist, actually, in the words of the Israelis, fired a rocket-propelled grenade at a tank nearby, and that basically precipitated the explosions, the buildings to actually detonate early, which was what killed 21 soldiers. There was a separate incident that killed three in southern Gaza as well. And President Isaac Herzog has spoken, and he said it is an unbearably difficult morning for the country.
Mr. Netanyahu also said in his comments that Khan Yunis in Gaza is now encircled.
Yeah, indeed. It's been very much the focus of the Israeli offensive in recent days because the Israelis believe that that is where the top Hamas commanders are holed up, either in the city or beneath the city in tunnels. And they now say that the Israeli Defense Forces say that they have completely encircled the city. There are still hundreds of thousands of people thought to be sheltering in Khan Yunis, and there are reports that the Israelis are besieging one hospital, at least one hospital there. They've stormed another hospital and arrested the medical staff. Israel insists that Hamas uses medical facilities to launch attacks on Israeli soldiers. That is something that both medics in Gaza and Hamas deny. But very much, I think Khan Yunis is in the grip of the Israelis now, and it's meant that actually many of the residents in Khan Yunis have been forced even further south into Rafah, right on the border with Egypt, which had a pre-war population of just under 300,000, but is now thought to be sheltering some 1.4 million people.
Hamas, of course, saying more than 25,000 people have now died in Gaza in this war, but reports, Mark, of Israel suggesting a two-month pause.
Well, this is a report that appeared in the US media and on the website Axios that said that Israel had proposed a two-month ceasefire or truce in which it would demand the release of all the hostages and the bodies of the dead hostages. Remember, Israel assesses that about perhaps up to 30 of the remaining 130 hostages or so in Gaza have been killed. In return for that, there would be an unknown number of Palestinian prisoners who would be freed from Israel, and Israeli forces would begin to withdraw from some areas in Gaza, but it hasn't yet. There's not been a word from Hamas yet, and I think we are still quite far from any deal, if indeed that is approved.
Mark Lowen. The Houthis, who control a large part of Yemen and are allies of Hamas, have warned that they will take revenge after America and Britain carried out their most extensive airstrikes yet. The Houthis say every aggression will meet a response. Several sites linked to the group were bombed overnight. It's the second time the US and UK have conducted coordinated retaliatory strikes on the Houthis' missile-launching operations in Yemen after weeks of attacks by Yemeni fighters on vessels in the Red Sea region. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, said the US and UK countermeasures sent the clearest possible message to the Houthis.
We are not seeking a confrontation. We urge the Houthis and those who enable them to stop these illegal and unacceptable attacks. But if necessary, the United Kingdom will not hesitate to respond again in self-defence. We cannot stand by and allow these attacks to go unchallenged. Inaction is also a choice.
From Gaza to Iran, Iraq to Yemen, barely a day goes by without reports of some new flashpoint in the region. We've heard warnings of the danger of a wider regional conflict. For the BBC's Five Questions On podcast, Unpacking Conflicts in the Middle East, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams, along with some of our regional experts, analyses these developments for you and look at where these disparate issues connect.
Clearly, something happened last October that brought a whole lot of regional tensions and rivalries out into the open in a dangerously violent way. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, has been following Israel's military campaign in Gaza since the beginning. 3.5 months on from the Hamas attacks of October the 7th, what has that campaign achieved? And how much longer is it likely to go on?
The immediate future does look set to involve more intense fighting in Gaza, particularly in Khan Yunis in the south, where dozens of Palestinians are reported to have been killed in the latest Israeli strikes. Also, continuing heartache for the Israeli families of the remaining 100-plus hostages held by Hamas, who've been holding rallies. But diplomatically, there's a lot going on which will shape the longer term. While public statements by Hamas and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu still seem far apart, there are said to be serious mediation efforts by Qatar and Egypt with US involvement on a possible new hostage release deal. And while Mr. Netanyahu's reaffirmed his hard line against the creation of a Palestinian state, saying it would pose an existential danger to Israel, we're not going to stop hearing about the two-state solution. Israel's allies, the US, the UK, and today the European Union with a meeting in Brussels, Arab countries too, all say they want to work towards this and that ultimately it's the only way to end the decades-old conflict here.
OK, next to the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, over 1,000 miles away. Now, the Houthis, that controls a big chunk of northern Yemen, started firing missiles towards Israel back in October, in solidarity, they said, with the Palestinians in Gaza. Then they turned their attention to shipping in the nearby Red Sea. The BBC's security correspondent Frank Gardner now picks up that thread.
Well, in one sense, these strikes by the US primarily have failed because the Houthis are still firing missiles at shipping, which they believe are either connected to Israel or the US or to the UK. But the Houthis haven't got an inexhaustible supply of missiles, and these are slowly being degraded by the US strikes. I think the US is hoping to send a message to Yemen that it can calibrate its response. It can step up these attacks. At the moment, they're being quite limited. They're only targeting very specific sites like radar, airfields and so on. But they could step that up if the Houthis try to escalate this. So it's still quite a worrying flashpoint in the wider sort of galaxy of Middle Eastern flashpoints.
Another volatile area since October has been Israel's northern border with Lebanon. For months, we've seen skirmishes between the Israeli army and Hezbollah, Lebanon's powerful Shiite militia. Hugo Bechega, another of the BBC's Middle East correspondents, is in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Hugo, where do we stand?
Well, Paul, at the moment, this violence between Hezbollah and Israel has been largely contained to the border areas between Lebanon and Israel. But miscalculation is always a risk, and I don't think the threat of a major conflict is over. Hezbollah has been calibrating its attacks because it doesn't want to trigger a major confrontation with Israel. And the Israelis have been threatening to give a strong response to Hezbollah. The defense minister in Israel has said the Israeli military could copy and paste what it's done in Gaza here in Beirut. And I think here, this is the fear that Israel could trigger a conflict. The rhetoric from Israeli officials is that, look, we're going to have to deal with Hezbollah. And we know that some senior figures inside the Israeli government are in favor of a major offensive against Hezbollah, which is something that could be catastrophic not only for Lebanon, but also for Israel. Hezbollah is much more powerful than Hamas. It has thousands of well-trained fighters, tens of thousands of missiles and rockets, including precision-guided missiles that can strike deep inside Israel. So any conflict between Israel and Hezbollah would be extremely dangerous and unpredictable.
Now, if there's one thing that links Hezbollah in Lebanon with Hamas in Gaza and the Houthis in Yemen, it's that all three are backed in one way or another by Iran. So what's Iran up to? Here's Kassra Naji of the BBC's Persian service.
Iran's policies in the region are decided by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and he has decided that he does not want Iran to get involved directly in a war in Israel or with the United States. The obvious reason being the imbalance of military power between Iran on one hand and Israel on the other hand, or between Iran and the U.S. There is another reason for that: lack of popular support for the regime as a whole or for a war a thousand kilometers away from Iran's borders. But by staying away from the war, the Supreme Leader and his Revolutionary Guard have opened themselves to the criticism from their own hardline supporters, their support base, that they are showing weakness. So one of the ways that Iran can project power is to launch occasional missiles into Iraq or Pakistan or Syria and say they have targeted Israeli interests or targeted terrorist hideouts. Or use their client militias in these countries, in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, to cause a lot of trouble, and they are causing a lot of trouble.
As we've already heard, America has found itself being sucked into this toxic Middle Eastern vortex. And so, since October, we've seen the Biden administration trying, repeatedly, to put out the fires. How's that going? Our Washington colleague Anthony Zurcher has had a front row seat as he's crisscrossed the region with the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken.
Hey, Paul. I've been on a couple of Antony Blinken's trips to the Mideast the past few months, and one message I've heard over and over from the U.S. Secretary of State and his team is that preventing a region-wide conflict is a central focus of their efforts. That's been reflected in all the ground we've covered on these trips: Turkey and Iraq, the Persian Gulf, Israel and the West Bank, Egypt, back and forth. The Americans have had mixed success, though. The clashes along the Israel-Lebanon border, for instance, haven't escalated into full-blown war, but the U.S. is now regularly bombing the Houthis in Yemen. The Americans ultimately see ending the Gaza war and settling the Palestinian issue as the only way to ensure a durable peace. The U.S. proposal is for the Arab nations to normalize relations with Israel, integration, in exchange for Israel working towards an independent, united Palestinian state that includes Gaza and the West Bank. Paul, you know that's obviously an enormous task, one that has stymied Mideast negotiators for a generation or more. But that's the U.S. roadmap for peace, and right now, they're sticking to it.
And for more analysis and explanation, why not subscribe to our Five Questions on podcast? It's available on BBC Sounds. Can Donald Trump's seemingly inevitable march towards standing for a second term as US president be stopped? Well, New Hampshire, seen as the last stand for the Republican never-Trumpers, could move us close to an answer. It's holding its primary today on who should be the Republican Party's candidate, the second state to vote after Mr. Trump secured a resounding victory in the Iowa caucuses. The former U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, is now the last person standing against him. Our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, is on the campaign trail.
New Hampshire's official state motto is Live Free or Die. And I'm stood in front of a majestic bronze statue covered in snow of the man who coined it, General John Stark, the state's most distinguished hero during the Revolutionary War. The motto is now used to convey the independence of New Hampshire. Nearly 40% of voters here are politically unaffiliated. And one man here is hoping to take advantage of that.
One sugar.
We meet Robert Schwartz at a local diner. He is from an organisation called Primary Pivot. He's a liberal activist who wants to stop Donald Trump's momentum.
So what's your name?
My name's Maggie.
You planning to vote in the primaries? Okay, are you a registered Democrat, Republican or undeclared?
Robert's strategy is this: get as many liberals and left-leaning independents to turn right and vote for Nikki Haley.
Nikki Haley is the only candidate that can dent Donald Trump and end this idea that he is the inevitable nominee.
When you go around speaking to potential voters, do they agree with your message? Does it resonate with any of them?
It is tough, but we have found a pretty large reception for left-leaning independent voters. Their top issue by far is how much they dislike Donald Trump and how much democracy is the central issue for them this election cycle.
Robert works the room hard.
And how are you thinking of voting?
And bingo, he's found a target, an independent voter who leans to the left.
Why do you think it's such a bad idea?
I'm personally just not for voting for someone who's trying to take away my rights as a woman. That's not our choice.
But what you're then doing is letting somebody overturn Roe v. Wade, right?
It didn't work. Not sure how many voters Robert got on board in this diner. It is a mountain to climb because polls suggest Trump is widening the lead over Haley by more than 20 percentage points.
We've crossed to another part of the state and come to Brown Lobster Pound. It's a local seafood fast food restaurant. Dozens and dozens of people are packed in, sat on benches, drinking big cups of soda, eating mac and cheese, fried shrimp and chips, waiting for Nikki Haley.
But as Nikki Haley arrives, news breaks that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is out.
It's now one fella and one lady left. Yeah. May the best woman win.
Why do you think Nikki Haley's going to win?
She's smart. She's an accountant. She's beautiful. It never hurts to be beautiful.
Donald Trump is petrified of her, which is exactly why he's lying consistently about her record.
But further up north, that confidence is matched by Donald Trump supporters waiting in the sub-zero temperatures for his sold-out event at the local opera house.
I think there's no question on Trump winning New Hampshire at all.
At this point, both Haley and DeSantis are just distractions and kind of irrelevant.
DeSantis has dropped out.
I know, yeah, and doubly irrelevant then.
Donald Trump isn't really a candidate, but more of a movement. If he wins New Hampshire by a huge amount, the race for the Republican nomination will more or less be over.
Nomia Iqbal in New Hampshire. And in fact, the first result from those primaries is already in. Nikki Haley won all six votes in the hamlet of Dixville Notch. Though I should say, 4 years ago, the Dixville Notch primaries were very poor predictors of the nationwide results. The Oscar nominations are in after a huge year for cinema, which saw Barbie and Oppenheimer dominate the box office. Who can forget the Barbenheimer phenomenon when millions of fans booked tickets to see both films on the same day? Well, Oppenheimer, about the project to develop the atomic bomb, has topped the list with 13 nominations, including Best Director and Best Picture. The feminist take on Barbie got 8, including Best Picture. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Cillian Murphy getting his first ever Oscar nomination for Best Actor for playing Oppenheimer. You've got Best Supporting Actress Emily Blunt for playing his wife. Director Christopher Nolan, who's never won an Oscar, now is the sure favourite to win his first Oscar for Best Director. The thing I cannot get over, Barbie's misses.
Okay.
I don't want to start on a negative, but Margot Robbie has been the face of movies for 2023, and she has missed out on a Best Actress nomination.
And Greta Gerwig
has missed out on Best Director. She made the most successful film at the box office of last year. She made the most successful film by a woman of all time. And for the second year in a row, there are no females nominated for Best Director at the Oscars. I'm afraid to say this will be making a lot of the headlines.
And what will people be saying? What will those headlines be saying about those two misses, do you think, Colin?
I think they'll be saying, what do you have to do to get nominated? It's been the Barbenheimer phenomenon. It's been talked about for months. These were the movies that got people back into the cinemas after the pandemic. Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie, absolutely crucial to that. Huge hit with the critics, huge hit with the box office, but the Oscars say no. Neither Margot Robbie for Best Actress or Greta Gerwig for Best Director. They have both missed out.
Colin Paterson speaking to Lucy Hawkins. The 96th Oscars ceremony will take place in Hollywood on March the 10th. Still to come in this podcast.
This one blood biomarker was able to predict whether somebody had the proteins in the brain that are the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease.
A potential breakthrough in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Just in case the current punishments weren't enough, Russia is planning to introduce a new law which says that anyone who criticizes the war in Ukraine can have their property seized. Dissenters already face possible prison sentences. Many have been jailed for even suggesting that invading Ukraine might not have been the best idea the Kremlin's ever come up with. But there's one group of critics which the Russian authorities appear unsure how to deal with: the wives of mobilised Russian servicemen. Indeed, some are growing increasingly vocal in their demand that their husbands be allowed to stop fighting and return home. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been speaking to some of these women and hearing their stories.
In a room on the edge of Moscow, something unusual is happening. Raised voices and public criticism of the Russian authorities. These women want their husbands back. The men are among the 300,000 reservists mobilized by President Putin more than a year ago for his war in Ukraine. Maria Andreeva is fed up waiting.
When will they decide that our husbands have discharged their military duty? When they are brought back to us with no arms and legs? When they can't do anything because they're just a vegetable? Or do we have to wait for them to be sent back in a zinc coffin?
Two weeks after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin told the Russian people no reservists would be needed for his special operation. Only professional soldiers. Half a year later, that changed. But in recent months, some of the wives of the mobilised men have met via social media, and together they're pressing for their husband's return. Once a week, by the Kremlin walls, after the changing of the guard, the women lay flowers at the tomb of the unknown soldier. They have differing views on the Ukraine war. Some say they support it, others clearly don't. What unites them is the belief that the draftees should no longer be part of it. Antonina's partner was 44 when he was called up.
There are some people who want to fight, who volunteer for it and sign contracts. Let them fight, but send us back our husbands who don't want to be there. They've done their duty to the motherland. Send them home.
No, say the authorities, who portray the women as Western stooges. The head of the Russian Parliament's Defence Committee has suggested that Russia's enemies are behind these demands for demobilisation. Can you imagine, he said, soldiers' wives in World War II asking Stalin to send their husbands home after a year on the front line? It wouldn't happen. But the Ukraine war is not the Second World War. In World War II, Russia was invaded. Today, it's invaded Ukraine. Maria Andreeva says she fears a second wave of mobilisation.
Some people act like ostriches. They stick their heads in the sand and try not to think about what's happening. I can understand them. It's hard to accept that in your country, the state doesn't need you to be happy. It just treats you as biological material. But if people want to survive, sooner or later they need to recognize this and say that they do not agree.
At the weekend, Maria and some of the other wives visited one of Vladimir Putin's election campaign offices in Moscow and got into a shouting match about the war. Extraordinary, in a country where the authorities go out of their way to silence dissent. Should the Kremlin leader be worried by this very public display of discontent? Well, listen to Antonina, previously a huge Putin fan.
This has changed my attitude to the authorities. I used to have enormous respect for Vladimir Putin. Now I'm more neutral. I still find it hard to believe that he knows this kind of thing is happening. But if he really does see us as traitors and outcasts for wanting our husbands back, I don't understand why he'd have this attitude towards citizens who once voted for him.
Seeds of doubt, the Kremlin will be hoping, will not take root.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Researchers say results from Swedish trials of a new blood test to detect Alzheimer's disease suggest it is as accurate as the painful and invasive lumbar punctures used currently. Experts say the test could revolutionise the early detection of Alzheimer's, which accounts for the majority of dementia cases, by becoming as routine as the screening for high cholesterol is now. My colleague Justin Webb sought more details from Dr. Susan Kohlhaas from the charity Alzheimer's Research UK.
This work looked at over 700 people across three different countries, and what they showed is that this one blood biomarker called p-tau217 was able to predict whether somebody had the proteins in the brain that are the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease with as much accuracy as current gold standard methods such as a lumbar puncture. And that's really important because for many years, diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease hasn't changed. And we know that our current process isn't good enough. We have currently 2% of people receiving an Alzheimer's diagnosis through this kind of gold standard method of a lumbar puncture or a PET scan. We don't have enough PET scanners in this country to diagnose at the rate that we need to. Many people are waiting 2, 4, even longer, many years to receive a diagnosis. This is a really encouraging study. I think the next steps are working out whether this result stands in populations that reflect the real world. So people going into clinics with memory concerns at an everyday level and making sure that these results still stand in those populations. And that's the work that's happening next.
Yeah. So that means then that when people talk about it being something that is available more broadly soon, we are still talking what? Are we quite a few years?
We're probably talking between 3 and 5 years, I think. So we need to do those studies and test whether these biomarkers work in real-world populations, and then they would need to go through regulatory approval as well. But what's really important is that this is really urgent now to sort, because we can see the time where treatments are just coming around the corner, that for the first time, slow progression of diseases like Alzheimer's disease. And if people can't get a diagnosis, they won't have access to those treatments. So it's really important that we sort this.
Dr. Susan Kohlhaas from Alzheimer's Research UK. The Canadian filmmaker Norman Jewison has died at the age of 97. He was best known for directing the racially charged drama In the Heat of the Night, made by the Mirisch Corporation. Peter Goffin has this report.
Made at the height of the civil rights movement, In the Heat of the Night starred Sidney Poitier as a black detective solving a murder in the Jim Crow South. It was less a whodunit than a depiction of defiance and dignity in the face of racism.
Virgil, that's a funny name for a boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
In the Heat of the Night cemented Jewison's reputation as a director of films with a statement to make. Even when Jewison made musicals, they were provocative. With Jesus Christ Superstar, a depiction of the Messiah as more human and less divine. Or, in Fiddler on the Roof, a family drama in the shadow of a deadly pogrom. Jewison retired in the early 2000s, but not before returning to familiar ground with The Hurricane. The film is based on the true story of Reuben Carter, a black boxer sent to prison in the 1960s for a murder he didn't commit. I felt that The Hurricane had a great deal to say about America now, the director once said. 50 years into his career, so did Norman Jewison.
Peter Goffin. A matador in Spain has become the country's first bullfighter to publicly reveal that he is not heterosexual. Mario Alcalde says he hopes coming out does not attract a negative response from within the often conservative, indeed macho, world of bullfighting. Guy Hedgeco is in Madrid and told me more about Mario Alcalde.
He's a 31-year-old from Madrid. He's not an extremely well-known bullfighter, but he gave this interview to El Mundo, which is one of the country's best-known newspapers, at the weekend, in which he talked about his sexuality. He identified as pansexual. He said, I identify with the LGBTQ flag. I fall in love with the interior of a person, not their gender. And he said that that obviously goes against the sort of the current in bullfighting, which, as you say, is known as quite a conservative world. And he talked about this ambition he has to have a sort of bullfighting fan club set up in the barrio or the neighbourhood of Trueca in Madrid, which is known as sort of the gay capital of Spain. And he says he wants gay people to be converted to bullfighting. Talked about that a lot. So he's an intriguing character, and there has been a lot of interest in the fact that he has come out this way.
How has the news gone down in the conservative world of bullfighting?
Well, we haven't had a great deal of reaction yet. I think that will come. We're not in the middle of the bullfighting season. That might explain it. But there has been some response. For example, Rafi Camino, who's a veteran matador, he said, I offer you all my support, my friend, on social media. He was very supportive. Other people have spoken out, not necessarily from within the bullfighting world, but there's been a political response. A socialist politician, Chema Crespo, said that this showed extraordinary bravery, and he talked about the utterly machista world of bullfighting and how difficult it was for someone to make an announcement like this. So far, all of the response has been pretty positive about this. The big question now, I think, is whether this is the beginning of something, whether we will see other bullfighters start to come out of the closet as well.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sam Dickinson, and the producer was Daniel Mann. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.